Well, the story of Cabrini
dates back to even the creation of the CHA in 1937. But before we go back into the timeline, Alejandro, I want to start with you. Where did your investigation begin? What prompted you to look into the story of Cabrini Green?
So, you know, we were, I was sitting in my house and I was watching TV and we were, I was kind of hearing about what was happening across the country and the calls for social justice and racial justice. And I kept thinking about Chicago and I kept thinking about ways in which segregation was still happening. I mean, you could see it. You can see it in Chicago. You take public transportation from the red line from the north side, from the south side. You can see how segregated the city is. And so my editors and I just began thinking about stories that we could do. Like, how did we get here was one of our leading questions. And we talked a lot about zoning. And eventually, one of those conversations led us to think about public housing. And we could not talk about public housing without talking about Cabrini Green. And to me, as someone who's not from the city, it was the realization that this neighborhood in the near north side where I would go for the REI store and I would go get to the Apple store was not always like that. And I could not believe that that once had been a black neighborhood. And when I go there now, it is not. And what happened was basically what led us to this investigation.
Yeah. Let's kind of go back into the history books. The neighborhood that Cabrini Green sits in has had many immigrant populations move through it from the late 1800s into the early 1900s. When CHA comes and designates the slums of this neighborhood as needing to be torn down and something replacing it, I'm over to you, Dilla. Who was living in this neighborhood during, you know, the late 1930s, early 1940s?
Great question. At that time, it would have been Italian immigrants or maybe the second generation of Italian immigrants, right? So the people who would have been in what they term Little Hell or in the geographic location of what Cabrini Green came to be, they were second generation Americans, but from their family, their fathers and mothers were from Italy.
And the story of what happened to those Italian immigrants, again, it's like this cycle we see. The city comes in, decides these are slums, decides they're going to put public housing. And you have the Francis Cabrini row houses that are completed in 1942. Alejandro, as you were looking through your reporting, what was the state of Cabrini when those row houses were completed?
It was not good. I mean, there were a lot of factories around that community. There was an earlier report from the city that spoke about some of the buildings themselves were not constructed in a way that they would last a while. Some of them were crumbling down. You could literally see soot in the houses that were there before most of those units were cleared out. But a lot of residents lived there, right? Like, and they lived there because they couldn't find housing elsewhere in the city. There was an affordable housing crisis, much like the way we talk about, the way we hear about today about affordable housing crisis. Literally, people could not go anywhere else. And so they were living in these communities and they're accepting these conditions because they couldn't go elsewhere. And because it was really close to factories, right? You could literally walk to Goose Island and get a job there. There was the Oscar Mayer factory was around there. There was Montgomery Ward factory around there. So there were plenty of jobs and opportunities, which is what people were looking for at the time.
Yeah. And during that time, you got thousands upon thousands of black folks moving to places like Chicago from across the South. And they're settling along the Black Belt, but they also settle near the Cabrini row houses. It's one of the first, it's the first integrated public housing space in the city of Chicago. Carol, when you think back to your childhood, when your family comes to the Cabrini neighborhood and it's starting to transition to a black neighborhood, what do you remember from those times?
I remember, you know, whites, blacks, all of us played together, you know. We were on a drill team together, you know. It was a community, you know. You know, that's my feeling as a community, you know.
I hear you. It was tight knit. People took care of each other, and then
people looked out for each other.
Yeah.
People, you know, help pay rent. You know, anything. You know, it was a community. Yeah. You know.
You know, before we get to the 90s, you know, when you think about Cabrini Green, Daylon, you've looked at some of the pictures, Charles, you know, the history. I've seen some of the pictures from the 1960s, the early 1970s. Like Carol said, you see drill teams, you see people at the swimming pool, you see manicured lawns, you see, you know, parks in good repair. Daylon, when you look at some of those old pictures compared, you know, to pictures in the exact same space years later, what'd you see from the archives about what Cabrini used to look like?
It was beautiful. It was gorgeous. You know, it reminded me a lot of home. I'm from Philly originally. And everything from like how the people were just like living and everything like that to, you know, in particular, there's this one photo, I don't know when it was from, but there's kids playing basketball with like the city skyline behind them. And like, I could not imagine just like, during like gym class or like after school or whatever, you're just doing all this with like the whole city around you. And to like see that vibrancy, to see the life, and like, you know, these things exist, right? Like, you know, communities, like gorgeous communities have always been like present, but to see like tangible existence of it, or like evidence of it, I should say, to then contrast that to now where like it just isn't that anymore. You know, in that CityCast episode on Thursday, Natalie referenced it as like a ghost town almost now. And it definitely like felt like that. I was walking around like at least like once a week, maybe like two or three times sometimes for the past like year and a half. And a lot of the times, I mean, COVID notwithstanding, like you would have a like ritzy looking white couple that's walking their dog or something like that, as opposed to like.
With the civil liberties union, somewhere around 67, 68, that the people being screened to come into public housing, that there was something about that changed. And then the CHA started playing games. Whole buildings of people were transferred. And then whole buildings of people were transferred in from the South Side, in particular from, I think, from Robert Taylor. I'm not sure. But a lot of things happened in the late 60s and when the rules changed. Now, instead of a flat rate, we want, what is it, 10%, 20% of your income, and 30% of your income. That's a little different. So the impetus was so for the people working to move out. Hey, I'm not paying 30% of my income when I can buy a home. You see, so that's what I mean.
So you feel like the processes, the way CHA was going about maintaining, but also staffing and filling the building, a lot of these things changed. I want to kick it down. Dylan, Alejandro, I know y'all can provide some more of this historical context. You know, what are some things that we see shift in the late 1960s into the 70s where, you know, public housing goes from, as Natalie put it in our episode, from housing the working poor to some of the poorest of the poor in the city?
The gentleman hits it on the head. There was a lawsuit that kind of changes. I liked how he phrased it. You know, it's the difference between like equity and being equal. Sometimes we change laws, we make things equal, and it hurts the equity of a situation, right? And that did happen with the move-in requirements for public housing across. But taking it back a step further, when you were talking about the infrastructure changes, a lot of people don't point out that Marina City was built at the exact same time as the Cabrini Green high-rises. And Cabrini Green,
Marina City is the corn cob.
The corn cob,
downtown,
as we call them in Chicago. And it's a gleaming example of Chicago architecture and might, right? They're the same age, and the Cabrini Green high-rises are not still standing, but the Marina City one is. And there's a reason behind that, too. The same gentleman by the name of Charles Schwiebel, was in charge of the Chicago Housing Authority for 20, 30 years, right? He was in charge of that expansion process. And he would divert material from the Cabrini Green high rise to Marina City, like down to the screw. I don't know, these good screws should go to my project over here. Both were funded with public money. You know, people don't talk about that. Like in 2022, you couldn't have a CHA head funding and in charge of what's supposed to be like a private real estate venture, right? But that's what happened. And so that's one thing that we should also pay attention to as it relates to Cabrini Green. Like it was, you know, at the highest level being neglected, right? When you have the person in charge of the CHA saying, you know, this particular material is too good for the people who are going to be living in projects, but send it over here to this high rise, right? So that's one thing. And then to go to another point, the funding all the way down the line kept changing, right? So, you know, at first it'd be funding. You talked about the difference between the pitchers. Residents were incentivized to take care of the place, right? They didn't necessarily bid for the highest contractor to see who's going to take care of the landscape. Now, 10 people from the area were selected to take care of the landscape. And when they started to do away with that, that's when you start to see further neglect taking place.
Alejandra, can you jump in here? You've talked to stories from people who've lived here across the decades. That shift we're seeing in the 70s and 80s, can you help continue to put that in context for us?
Yeah, so you also have the way the public housing is funded is through the federal government, right? So the federal government HUD kind of funds the CHA locally, the CHA, and the CHA has the budget to maintain and at that point own, maintain, and operate the public housing buildings. And it is true that there were a lot of scandals. The CHA was mismanaged, and there are a number of federal reports that kind of corroborate everything that has been said so far. And also, there was a shift in Washington in the way, in the question about how do we house people who are poor and how much we as a nation are going to spend housing people who are poor, right? And so the funding kept being cut. And with the mismanagement of the funds, but also the amount of money coming in being less and less and less, that's when you see the buildings turn to get into disrepair. By the time you get into the 80s and the 90s, there were a number of units at Cabrini Green that were empty. Apartments were completely empty, and the CHA was boarding them up instead of repairing them. And that created... the community began to shift, right? When you start seeing that your landlord is not really paying attention to the units and is not really wanting to fix the units, and you see empty units all around you, units that are boarded up, that's also when you start seeing a lot of problems with the elevators of the buildings, that the elevators were not being kept up, the hallways were not being kept up, the trash was not being kept up. And I think that what is really interesting about the story that has been told in Chicago is that the residents were at fault when it was really the landlord who was responsible for maintaining those buildings and those units was not doing its job.
Carol, I'm going to come back to you, Charles. I'm going to go to Carol real quick. I mean, you had to watch this shift take place in your lifetime from, again, manicured lawns and, you know, thousands of families enjoying themselves to things slowly starting to shift. How was it during, you know, the 1970s watching as, you know, less and less care was being given to these buildings?
Well they called it de facto demolition. You know, management wasn't doing a job. It was a whole series of things that they didn't do. We took care of what CHA didn't take care of. You know, we fixed on what's in our houses. We took care of the outside, you know, we did what CHA didn't do, you know. So, when all this started, you know, they was shortage of 250,000 affordable housing, you know. So their transformation plan, you know, was too aggressive, you know. Why tear down everything when you already got a shortage of housing?
Did you feel abandoned?
Well, it was not abandoned by CHA. We kicked in and, like I said, started doing our own repairs.
You may do.
We may do. Mm-hmm.
Charles, I know you want to jump in, and then I had a question for Shakira as well.
Charles Zweibel. Charles Zweibel indicted 19 times. 19 times, and that's on record. Why would he still remain the chairman of the board for CHA, and he was indicted 19 times? That tells me that something was going on in Hood. Something was definitely going on with the city. And I'll be brief, make no mistake, Chicago used to run Hood. I've been in meetings, where Hood scared to death of Chicago. I mean, scared to death. Moving the work program, monitored in Washington. No one in Chicago to monitor the program. Now, how do you do that? They talking back and forth. Me talking to somebody in Washington, I can tell you if you're in Washington anything, because I know you're not coming here. But once again, that was very interesting. Charles Zweibel, Marina City, CHA. And he was a partner in the development. So was Eddie Radoliak. So was a couple of famous aldermen. Jane Burns' husband, Jay McMillan. There's a lot of people. See, so, and then the other thing is, you talked about the poor. Yeah, but you see, public housing then was poor whites and poor blacks. I want to see how it got to be all poor black.
See, CHA had a policy shift, right? So when the Francis Cabrini row houses are built, that area, it was 75% roof, basically. That was like on record.
CHA had a policy shift. Right, so when the Francis Cabrini row houses are built, that area, it was a 75% rule, basically. And that was like on record in the CHA office. And so 75, whatever the race was in that area, they tried to fill the housing with 75% of that race. And again, same thing with the consent decrees, right? When you start to relax, you're trying to equal it all out. You know, you remove that without putting any other kind of safeguards. So they say, okay, well, you're right. We won't make it 75% in any neighborhood no more. We'll just fill them as they come. But then now they just put all the blacks in there, right? And there's nothing, no stopgap at all. They didn't ask for any. So that's how that change happened. And a great story to research will be the Trumbull Park story, the Trumbull Park riot. It explains it beautifully on how the race shift in the housing projects.
Mm-hmm. Shakira, I want to bring you in here. What are some of the stories or oral histories that you've collected about Cabrini Green, and which ones have really stuck out to you?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. It's really great to be here. But one of the most important things that I think I overall hear when I'm doing this type of work and dealing with current and former residents of public housing is the fact that they actually take the initiative to talk to me and to help share those stories and say, like, hey, bad things happen in Cabrini Green, yes, but bad things happen everywhere. And I think that's really powerful when we come to looking at history and how that impacted the current times now, and then how that'll have an impact on the future, because a lot of people were displaced. So when you, so I actually got the opportunity to go walk around Cabrini Green one time. One of my really good friends, Shaq, he's from Cabrini Green, and we went to go walk around the neighborhood. And from the outside looking in, you would say, like, hey, these buildings over here, they gated off. But then you look directly across the street in some of the row houses, and there's still families there. There is still a sense of a community. So despite having to wake up every day and look at housing that's not being revitalized, or housing that was promised for some residents to be able to come back, for them to have to see that every day and then to say, hey, like, we have a history here, we're still here, is, I think, is a really good thing. So one of the main experiences that stick out to me is Shaq actually told his, one of us took his oral history, and one of the things he said, it's Cabrini Green is a vibrant community full of vibrance, and it has violence too. And when he was telling his story about, like, his family and the residents and waking up every day, it's the idea of, yeah, I don't like when people tell these stories for us, because they don't speak on all the things that actually go on in the community. That's not the bad things that you always hear. So anytime that I meet with somebody who's from Cabrini Green, or even just having the experience of walking through, because that particular time we had cameras, but, you know, we didn't take pictures right away because we didn't want people to feel like they were a case study. And most of the time when we have conversations like this and we have opportunities to discuss what went on, and sometimes having those conversations are difficult because living in a community that you've seen so many great things happen, so many entrepreneurs, so many people who fight for housing, and still sometimes their voices are left unheard. And I think that's the great thing about the work that I do, because it gives people a voice. Me personally, coming from public housing, I stayed there for about 12 years, and I felt like before I didn't have a voice, but now doing this work, being the avenue that people can reach out to and say, hey, you tell your story the way you want to tell it, because your experience, you know, is important, and not letting somebody else tell that for you, but actually just being an opening ear for people who come from that community, really stands out in itself.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your friend Shaq. Is that the same Shaq from 70 Acres who lived at Cabrini with his grandma? Yeah, like he was training dogs. I listened to his story so much, and one thing that he, like, made clear time and time again was, like, this was our home. This is where we lived. The stories that we're hearing about where we grew up, they have an impact on us. You know, Carol, what was it like to, like, basically be told that this is y'all's fault?
I didn't accept that, you know, it was our fault. You know, I seen mismanagement. I seen they allowed the property to go down. They put $50 billion in one building and then they tore it down. You know, so, yeah, you know, I guess it's been a long struggle, you know, activists in this community, and it's been a long time, you know, that's why I asked Charles Price to come, because it's overwhelming, you know, to see the things that's happening to CHA not just Cabrini, all public housing. We was a coalition to protect public housing, and we went to all 19 developments to ask people to stay, you know, but they scared them off by telling them, we gonna take your kids, we gonna cut off the lights, you know. So people got scared and they ran, you know. So
I'm gonna come back down to that. You know, we talked a lot about HUD. They take over CHA in 1995. There was already this sense amongst the residents that, like, you know, as Willie told me, they're going to take that skyline eventually. They're coming for this land eventually. Alejandra, as we get into the 1990s and buildings are starting to be torn down, even without a plan, how was that initially being kind of packaged and communicated to folks?
And this is where Carol still comes into the story of Cabrini Green intersects there, right? I mean, she was a resident there already, but she was an activist back in the 90s. Cora Moore was also an activist back then. People are smart. They know what's happening. They know what happened before, and they can see it all around them. It's almost the way I thought about it when I was reading the reports from the business community, when I was reading the newspapers calling for the mayor to do something about Cabrini Green. It's almost like a drumbeat, right? It's a drumbeat. Every time you see the headline, every time you can see it in national news, you can see it on TVs, in 60 Minutes, there's reports, right? It's the drumbeat to, like, what's going to happen? What are you going to do, Mr. Mayor, about Cabrini Green? And so we're in the 90s. This is Mayor Richard Daley, whose father was also mayor of Chicago. And he was under tremendous pressure to do something about Cabrini Green. This is also, you know, the era of the war on drugs, right? The era of people being labeled, even young black men being labeled criminals, right? And so there was, it seemed that everything was aligning to wanting to really displace this community. There was a plan to convert downtown Chicago and to make it what it is today. The beauty of Millennium Park was not there yet, right? It was still in the planning process. And the mayor wanted it to be a city in which young people could live and walk to work. And you cannot get any closer than the near north side. And so at that time, with all of this happening locally and nationally, there was some money coming out from HUD that basically given money to the CHA to do something, right? The $50 million, it was sort of a grant to do something about Cabrini Green. And plans started coming out. And initially it was, well, we'll demolish one building, we'll demolish two buildings. Developers around Cabrini Green kind of saw this happening and they started gobbling up land. There were a lot of factories that had closed at that point. I mean, we're still part of the Rust Belt here in Chicago. So there were a lot of manufacturing plants that were empty, like the developers gobbling up the land and then pushing for the city to do something because their plan to redevelop the area would only work if you do something about Cabrini Green, right? Because the idea was that they wanted to bring people who were more affluent to live in that community. And developers knew at the time that if Cabrini Green was still standing, they were not going to be able to make good on their investment, right, to create these communities. So that leads us to 1996, which is when the mayor, Mayor Daley, actually announces this plan, his vision for Cabrini Green. There was a conference downtown, and lo and behold, the community residents who have been talking about wanting to be at the table, who wanted to be at the table, who had their own plans for the communities, were not there. They were not invited. And the press took notice. And after that press conference, there was a landmark lawsuit, the 1996 lawsuit where Ms. Carol Still is one of the plaintiffs, basically asking to be at the table. The residents wanted to be at the table and wanted to be a part of what the future would be for Cabrini Green. And in 1997, which is how we opened the story, really, is there was this community meeting where the mayor sent some of the well-known black politicians to Cabrini Green to tell them what the poem was going to mean. And it didn't go well. And Carol, I remember you told me this story about how you basically marched in. It was to that meeting held in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Carol, Charles, I mean, between the killing of Dantrell Davis in October of 92 till they started tearing down the buildings in 1995, what was it like living in that uncertainty as they were making plans for your neighborhood without you involved in them? Can you slide the mic down for me, Charles? And then, Charles, same question to you after Carol, okay?
I was out there that day Dantrell got killed, you know, and they had a police car out there, a paddy wagon, you know, that watched the kids, you know. And I was on one side of the building, on the opposite side of the building, when I heard the gunshots. And I ran to the other side of the building, and the police was getting out their cars because they was in there reading the newspaper. You know, so, you know, Dantrell, you know, he wasn't the only one killed, but that's the one they made a martyr out of.
Let me just piggyback on what she was saying. I managed the building that Dantrell and his mother lived in, 50502 West Oak. So I came downstairs and I saw Ann walking Dantrell to school. And when the shots were fired, you know, and that there's just something about, there's a sound that 30-06 makes. It's, if you ever have the experience to be by one when it goes off, it whistles as it passes you. And I'm in coming out of 500. She was going across the street to Jenner School. And there was nothing left of that kid when I got to her. And, but prior to that, like a week earlier, I did a memo. See, I'm working for CHA, saying that, hey, these upper floors are dangerous because the week before, I think 7 people got shot coming from the same high rise where Dantrell eventually got killed from. And they would board the window up, somebody would come behind them and take it down and shoot. And this went on constantly. It was as if, well, we're not gonna really seal this up. We're gonna see what will happen. And something did happen, you know, and that was the death of that young man. And that's when there was an acceleration now of these buildings got to come down. Because the buildings didn't have to come down. All you had to do was keep them up. You know, just keep repairing. You know, when you got vacancies in a high rise, let me just, one other thing. Same building, 19th floor. When the building was sealed off at the 12th floor, we go up to the 19th floor one day, and there's a 50 caliber machine gun bolted down to the floor. Bolted down to the floor, and it had a perfect look at the row houses and Chicago Avenue, because that 50 caliber would reach up there. So when I say it was bolted down, it was professionally bolted down. See, brothers didn't do this. You had to have a hydraulic, you had to have a lot of stuff. And guess what? When we got it out of there, nothing was said about it in the papers. Nothing was said about it on the news. You know, we're going to keep this hush-hush. But when I tell you that thing was drilled down in the floor, it was drilled down through cement. So I know average guy couldn't have done that.
I just wanted to very quickly make the distinction between, because like I feel like this gets confusing sometimes. Like there was a community that lived in Cabrini Green, what we talked about at the beginning, like the neighbors knowing each other. And if I remember correctly, some of the things that were happening in the empty units. So kind of tying it to those empty units, no one knew who was living in those empty units. If anyone, I believe that the person who was accused of shooting the young boy shot from an empty unit. So that, when we talk about the violence in Cabrini Green, I feel like a lot of people make the connection of like, well, the community must be violent. But if you say that, you're saying that the Black community was violent. So you're saying that Black people are violent, and that is not true. There is absolutely nothing. There's no research, nothing that justifies that kind of logic. And so I want people who are listening to understand that, right? It's like the community was not violent. There were violent people who lived there and who moved in there, I mean, some of them who just were there, but that's different from the community that we refer to, we talk to about.
The story of, I'm sorry, it matches perfectly. The story of Candyman, which we know is based out of Cabrini Green, like the premise of that is what the residents went through, right? Like, no one liked the Candyman, no one wanted to live with the murderer, right? But you understood that just no one was going to come rescue from that either. You weren't going to get any additional help, and I think that's why it makes that story so perfectly fitting there. The residents of Cabrini Green certainly were doing their best to get rid of those who were causing the most problem. But here's the thing, though, on how, like, just historically how Chicago police have been moving as it relates to the projects. You report somebody, they don't go and try to, like, help you, right? You know what I mean? They, like, Shirley in 3A said she saw you. You know, like, that's how policing was done there. You were not incentivized at all to help law enforcement because you were not going to get any protection whatsoever. And then a lot of the vacant apartments, they start to come as a result of Jane Byrne's trick that she pulled in 81. Before 1981, you didn't have a lot of vacant apartments. And then the ones that were vacant, right? So if I live in 3A, I know that the unit next door from me, maybe I told my sister or somebody to move in there, right? After the Jane Byrne incident, you know, the vacants stopped being recorded. They don't keep track of who was vacant, and that leads to a problem.
But just to piggyback on what you're saying, Candyman, the interesting thing was that was kind of like true because the lady did call and say the man was coming through the wall.
Oh, then there's
but
that.
But he was coming through the wall because in the 05 apartments, they're back to back. 05 in one building is connected to the 05 in the next building. So you could come through the medicine cabinet in the bathroom, and they thought the lady was crazy because she was saying the man was coming through the wall. And he was coming through the medicine cabinet.
End up killing a lady. And then that's another thing that goes back to our original point of shoddy architecture, right? Like the thought is if something's wrong with the apartment on this end, I can go to the back apartment and fix your plumbing through the wall with zero thought to security or any of that. Like we report out, it's even now where we always report the most tragic part, the deaths parts. A lot of people was terrorized. Women wouldn't use the bathroom at night if they had one of those type of bathrooms. Like people would leave a bucket in their bedroom because you didn't want to go in a bathroom at night because you might walk in on a guy breaking in, you know. It was that type of serious.
Yeah. We You mentioned earlier Jane Byrne, who at the was the mayor at the time in the 80s, decided in 1981 to so-called move into Cabrini to kind of send a larger message, which, I mean, when you pull up in a limousine and security guards and bolt yourself in, it ends up sending the message that you too are afraid of this neighborhood. Alejandra, your report is so much about broken promises. And we talk about the broken promises of CHA maintaining these homes throughout the late 60s and the 70s, the broken promises of CHA turning its back on residents throughout the 80s. But then Mayor Daley comes out and makes more promises to the residents, not only in 1996, but again in 1999, where he promises people whoever wants to stay in this community can stay. Can you talk about how these promises from the city sort of build up? What were those promises that were being made to Cabrini Green residents in the mid-1990s?
And I think, you know, a lot of the times also the storyline is like residents kind of just took it and no one fought back, and that is completely inaccurate. They got really smart and they went to the courts. And they did not just believe what the mayor was saying in the podium. They wanted it on paper, and they got it. So there was that lawsuit in 1996. The mayor did verbally promise that anyone who wanted to return will be able to return. What they ended up getting in writing was that residents will be able to return. And they were what we call the famous list. There were two lists created. One of them was a list of residents who lived from 1993 to 1999 in units and had already been displaced by the time this agreement was settled in court in 2000. And then the other list was from the people who were living there as of October of 1999. And so what's interesting is that in the end, the people who actually got this like right to return, what we call the right to return, is less than the number of families who once lived in Cabrini Green. So we're talking about 3,600 apartments, and only a portion of the people in those 3,600 units and 3,600 families were allowed, given this right to return. So what we ended up doing with the investigation was tracking. I wanted to know the promises, right? How do we track them? So we track whether or not people were able to return. You know, it's been 25 years since then. How much money we've spent, and the jobs, whether or not construction jobs were actually, the 2,500 construction jobs that were promised to people were actually delivered. What we found is that, this is based on CHA's own tracking, that less than 20% of the people that were, when Mayor Medaley said, like, anyone who wants to come back will be able to come back, actually have returned to Cabrini Green, or at some point returned to Cabrini Green, the new Cabrini Green, right? Like the new community that was built there. With the rest, we have about 400 people that the CHA cannot track. They have lost them. They don't know where they are. We have another 100, 600 people or so who moved elsewhere in the city using a voucher. We have people who have given up, people who have died. We still have 85 people in the list waiting to come back to Cabrini Green today, 25 years later. And then the other part of that is that the city was going to build houses, right? They were going to create these new communities, and as they were creating these new communities, people were going to be able to come back and live in Cabrini Green. And the CHA and the city have moved really, really, really slow. Something that Dila said earlier about using public funds to be able to build communities. We have used already more than $1.4 billion redeveloping Cabrini Green. That is public money that has gone to the creation of the beautification of parks, for a public walkway along the river, for this, what we call mixed income communities, right? So apartments in which you have really wealthy people living next to public housing residents. And that has all been created with public dollars. And there is another $600 million that were allocated last year to finish the construction of Cabrini Green, because it's taken so long and it's not done yet. The number of public housing units that were promised to residents have not been delivered.
Yeah. I'm going to come down here, but I wanted to ask Shakira a question. I know she's listened to so many testimonials from people who wanted to come back to public housing or who were promised Was there very, like, when you listed those stories, did people have a lot of skepticism about the promises they were hearing be made about their ability to take part in, as you know, Alejandra said, the new Cabrini Green or these new public housing communities?
I would say definitely yes when it comes to even the idea of this promise, oh, you can come back, right? It's like when I hear the oral histories and I'm recording and meeting with the people, it's the idea of like, what am I coming back to? It's not going to be the same. And in a way, they're right, because you have this once vibrant community, despite whatever, you know, bad things went on. And you had a community there, so you can go next door. Like, a lot of the times I hear stories of people who are able to like go next door and like ask for a cup of sugar, or like have somebody watch your kids if you're busy or if you have to work, or just that overarching idea of a real sense of community and everybody took care of everybody. And a lot of the times those are the stories that we don't hear. And I think when people discuss with me wanting to come back to the neighborhood, because one idea is location, 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 right? So it's just like, it's a great location. It's close to downtown, it's close to opportunities you might not necessarily have access to. But then it's just like, who's gonna be managing these buildings if we do come back? And what initiatives are the public housing residents gonna be able to take? And it's a lot of the times when people that come from public housing didn't necessarily have access to something, they came together and they did it together because they were that community, they were that resource when you don't have access to something. So when people talk about the idea of coming back, it's just like they say they don't mind coming back, because once some place is your home, it'll always be your home no matter how far you go. But some people say they also don't want to come back because they'll be coming back to something that's new. And if you've lived somewhere, if you had like 2-3 generations of family who come from an area and then they're displaced, the idea of coming back doesn't seem normal, because then you have people who didn't necessarily come from your same background looking at you like you don't belong when this is where you came from. And that's a lot of times of the stories that we hear of, you know, the sense of when I moved somewhere else and I had to move out of Cabrini or I had to move out of public housing, my neighbors weren't my neighbors anymore. And inside the public housing development, most people are able to like knock on your door, like, hey, I'm your neighbor. They introduce your families, like they hang out, but then you go to a new place and it's just like, you don't have that anymore. Everybody's like in and out their house, or they look at you like, I don't know what this person's about. And a lot of the time it's those preconceived notions of, oh, I don't like, if you see, I think a really good example that I've heard before and I've even experienced before is like you move into a neighborhood and you see a single woman maybe with her kids and she's screaming at her kids, but that's the first interaction you see of her. That's the first thing that you're gonna remember about her every time you see. So maybe she can be like a really great person, but on that day she was having a bad day, she was frustrated with the kids, but you don't get to see that personal experience with her because you only take the face value of what you see the first time you see people from public housing. And a lot of people who don't know about public housing don't really see the significance of the idea that no matter where you come from, like, I belong here. And I think when it comes to having discussions like this and being able to interact with residents, we say we're just normal people. You never ask about us. And I also hear that a lot when I'm recording oral histories, because they say, if you would just ask me, or if you would just experience a day that I experienced, you wouldn't think this about me just because of where I come from. But I think that if overall they had the experience of the property just being updated and taken care of, opposed to you putting a bunch of people in one space and giving them lack of opportunity and lack of resources, then maybe if they had those things, it would have been a different outcome.
Mm-hmm. can you slide the mic down to Carol for me? Carol, you, throughout your life, you lived in not only in the Cabrini-Green neighborhood, but you watched the Reds and the Whites get finished. You watched as the neighborhood transformed. You fought tirelessly for CHA to be held accountable. And yet, with all of that, those towers were still destined to come down. What was it like throughout the mid-1990s up until 2011 when the last tower came down? What was it like watching your community slowly but surely shrink around you?
I wasn't president then when they had, you know, they usually go by what the president says. From 205 to 209, they had a president in there that allowed the buildings to come down. I was president of row houses. That's why we had some safeguards on there, because the row houses was eligible for historical preservations, and they can't do nothing with it until, you know, the president said it could come down. And I'm not letting it come down. But under I won't say his name. Under his dude, watch, you know.
Dude or buddy.
All the buildings came down.
I mean, what was that like? I mean, JR told me he was like, if you're used to seeing 15,000 people, and with each building, that's thousands of people you don't see anymore, your friends, your family. I mean, just what was that like having to say bye so many times?
Well, giving me, you know, 75% of the people from Chicago Avenue, North Avenue, I knew, you know, so it was heartbreaking, you know. We asked people to stay, you know. But, you know, they got scared off, you know. Like I said, they went after all the other developments, and eventually they came back for Cabrini-Green. And that was heartfelt, you know. The last building came down in 2012. Which was 1230 Berlin, you know, a building they had put a lot of money in because the residents was going to buy the building, but they tore it down, you know.
Yeah, Charles, you can slap the mic to you, Charles. It, same question, though.
Well, let me just
you can keep ask it closer a question. To you.
Let me just ask a question. I let $1.5 billion that Daley was talking about putting into public housing. You know, it's similar to the question that the guy asked in the picture, what was the lifespan of a second lieutenant in Vietnam? How much money do you think black folk made off that $1.5 million?
Kick it down to Alejandro, right? That's a good number, because my answer is a fraction.
A reference, so the $1.5 billion that Mr. Price is referencing is initially Daley announced just the transformation of Cabrini-Green, but by the time 2000 came around, he unveiled what was called the Plan for Transformation, which was a plan to reduce the number of public housing units across Chicago, right? Cabrini-Green is one of a number of public housing communities.
I think they tore down up to 20,000 units across the city.
But let me ask you that question for you. $150,000 out of $1.5 billion. That's what black contracts.
And so that's an interesting number. I hadn't heard it before, but I zoomed in just on Cabrini-Green itself. And what we found was that black contractors there were not a lot of them who were part of the transformation of Cabrini Green. I was counting what they're called prime contractors. So the way it works, it's a bit complicated, but the CHA is essentially the whole, it has the money, the city and the CHA have the money, and then they hire a developer to redevelop a community. That developer in turn hires a prime contractor, and that prime contractor in turn hires subcontractors. So as you can see, it gets a lot difficult to track the money because it gets diluted time and time again. So I was counting prime contractors for Cabrini Green. I wanted to know which ones were former, because the promise was to Cabrini Green residents, whether or not I could find a former Cabrini Green resident who was a prime contractor on Cabrini Green. And I found one who is just recently, in the last year actually, was for the first time hired to redevelop or develop 48 units in an area, not even what used to be CHA.
You're saying between 96 and 2021, you could only find one black contractor, and that was just in the last year.
I could only find one.
No, let me just say, as far as, well, when I came here, I didn't have that many friends. I'm going to have even less when I leave. But CHA, the city, I won't say that they're liars. I'll just say that they prevaricate all the blank time. We can go Target, Larrabee and Division. We're going to give the CH Cabrini residents the top five jobs over there.
78 jobs.
Well, I mean, but the top five, the manager, this, that, more pre-verification. You know, you can address how many jobs we got out of Cabrini.
Well, I think the top jobs didn't no resident get, because they use their own, they say they use their own people to hire within. But I guess about 10 residents got a job, you know, due to the fact that, you know, and it's not like it wasn't followed, you know. We questioned it, you know, and all CHA could say is, well, we do better next time in the deals we make, you know. Yeah.
Just kept pushing it down the line and down the line. So you couldn't move back. You couldn't work in the community. You didn't get jobs to help redevelop the community. And in the communities many people moved to, you've rarely felt welcomed.
And the Target is actually important, because it's not just a Target store that just popped up into any kind of line. That was the land where a public house, one of Cabrini Green Towers, used to be, where the Target is today. So the CHA swapped the land with Target. They got land slightly north of their Target, had land that was not continuous. It was broken down by a couple of streets, and the store wanted one continuous piece of land to be able to build the store. So they swapped the land, and they told residents that not only that we're going to get jobs, so to get them to be okay with this swap, but also that the CHA was going to build more public housing units in the land that they had swapped. So the public housing units have not been built, and as Carol can attest to, the number of jobs that were promised to residents did not materialize in the ways that.
Well, and to piggyback on that, the land that they swapped for, now they're trying to sell it and put the money in a general fund. Now, that's Cabrini's land that they want to sell now and put the money in a general fund. And when you put the money in a general fund, that means that it's not coming back. It's going to, you know.
D, I had a question for you. I wanted to bring it back to you. As you know, we all, even though most of us are Chicago natives, you know, have our varying level of understanding of this history. As somebody who's looking at this history play out across photographs, you know, like, how shocking were you to realize that this community you've been walking up and taking pictures of used to house thousands of black folks over here every single day? Like, how kind of jarring was that?
I don't take it for granted at all. This kind of phenomenon is happening right now in so many different places around this country. And it's something painful that, like, I've dealt with, like, throughout my life. And a big part of why I even got into journalism in the first place. So when I got on the assignment, that's all I was thinking about the whole time of, like, what did the pictures look like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? So what do, like, these pictures look like now? Just always, like, comparing and contrasting. It hurts, honestly. It hurts every time that I would at least come on every Saturday and just walk around and take photos. Every time that I would, like, go back home that evening, I had to, like, get some junk food on the way home and just kind of, like, have a lot of, like a safeguard in place, because it's painful to think about, like, how systemic this is, how, like, intentional all this is. And then you think about, like, how much attention that Cabrini Green got and how many, like, strong people you had within that fight to battle back against it while it was happening, and how it still, like, was gentrified within 20 years. It hurts. It hurts to think about the neighborhoods I come from. It hurts to think about the projects and neighborhoods that it's happening to right now. And just bringing it back to, like, the visual aspect, like, I just don't take it for granted that, like, I'm capturing it, like, how it is now, knowing that, like, it looks drastically different and feels drastically different than what it would have looked like before. I didn't grow up in Cabrini Green. I didn't grow up in Chicago even, but I can only imagine that, like, the same pain I get when I'm walking through Frankfurt or when I'm walking through Kensington or Fishtown and back in Philly is, like, the same kind of feeling that, like, folks would get here right now. It's just a whole different world, and you're not a part of it, even though people said you would be. So, yeah.
Again, yeah. The story and the history of Again, the story and the history of Cabrini Green is the history of promises, from the promises Edward Kelly made back in the 40s to the promises that mayors made throughout the 80s and 90s. But now we have a mayor in 2022 who has made their own promises about future development of Cabrini Green and promised another $600 million to see this project forward. Before we wrap, Alejandra, what is next for this neighborhood? Because as I walk, yes, I see the Groupon and the Target, but I also see the row houses surrounded by fences. So what's next for Cabrini Green?
So the alderman of the ward, Alderman Burnett, by the way, we asked to sit down with him, and he declined to speak with us in the record, as did Mayor Lightfoot and the Housing Commissioner and the CHA's leader, Tracy Scott. But they all, when the additional $600 million were approved, and the $600 million come in something called a TIF, Tax Increment Financing, which is a special taxing district that essentially will help pay for the development there. So they promised that money will be used to fulfill the promises made to residents 25 years ago or so. And so that will be a big question, right? Like, whether they will actually finish building the public housing units that they had promised, because in recent years, the CHA has moved to use some of the money allocated for Cabrini Green to rehab what are known as single occupancy rooms, which are for a different, they're needed. They're really needed in Chicago. SRO advocates say that this is, like, a really good move by the CHA. The problem is that they're using the pool of money that was set aside for former Cabrini Green families. Families do not live in tiny little one-studio apartments. And so if they're saying that they're fulfilling the promise by building SROs, is that really fulfilling a promise? So what exactly will happen with this $600 million? What will happen with the row houses? They had initially promised that 100% of the row houses would be public housing, and they have since walked back that promise. Now residents are fighting for just hopefully up to 40% of the row houses to be public housing. There are a number of public or of empty parcels of land. Residents in the community want them to be green spaces for parks. But there is still hundreds of public housing units that were promised that have not been developed at a time in which the city is facing one of the worst affordable housing crises that it's undergone. So I think that this is a time for residents to continue to question their leaders. What will happen with the money? Why do we need it in an area that has become so wealthy? And who will benefit from that money going forward? Now that we know that the promises were broken, now with what do we do with that knowledge going forward?
Before we wrap, I do want to give the last words to Charles and Carol. Y'all are the voices representing the people who lived here. So go ahead, Charles. Can you move closer to the mic for me, Charles?
Yeah. Let me just say this. Ms. Steele is being attacked by the city, by CHA, and she's fought for free residents, for residents of Cabrini. All her life, she's been fighting. Now, I hate to say it like this, but it has to be said. Had a young white guy work for CHA, stole $50 million from the CHA's pension plan, and invested it in a motion picture in Hollywood. Read the paper, I think I saw maybe two lines about it. Ms. Steele here, hell, they had a whole, you know, like 15 pages of El Toro manure, you know. But that's how they do our leaders. That's what we allow them to do to our leaders. And please help Ms. Steele, because she's fighting principalities, CHA and this mayor, city hall. And just one other thing, for those of you that's attacking me, and you know who you are, all I can do is tell you, you know, like they told Caesar, beware, for the eyes of March are upon thee.
Ms. Steele, I want to finish out with you before we wrap here. You've heard all the promises. You've seen all the back walking. You've watched new administration after new administration kind of give hollow words. What do you hope is next for your community?
Well, it's not what I hope. Is they're going to rehab row houses. They don't know it yet, but row houses wasn't supposed to be torn down in the beginning. Neither was other developments, you know, but they tore them down anyway. But, you know, I hope the row houses get, I don't know, hope, I, when the row houses get rehabbed, I wanted the residents to come back to it. Cause the residents want to come back, you know. I'm president, and I get so many calls a day, people wanting to come back. But this last group of houses Holston had, they took people off the wait list. You know, so, you know, a member of the gang, came and told me I had never seen him before in my life. He said they waiting for you to die so they can tear down the row houses. You know, so I ain't planning on dying, you know.
Talk your shit.
So, okay. So.
Well, Ms. Steele, I appreciate you for joining us, for all the work that you've put in as you've watched this story play out throughout your lifetime. Charles, thank you for joining this panel. Devon, Dilla, Alejandra, Shakira, to the BGA, Catchlight, and everybody who works at CityCast Chicago. I'm so grateful for everybody who took the time to watch this panel after the fact. We are all so deeply sorry for the technical issues. If you can only see how hard we were working in here to bring this to you, you'd forgive us so swiftly. Thank you to everybody on this panel for y'all's patience. It truly is a pleasure and an honor. I feel the least qualified of everybody up here, but so grateful nonetheless. So again, thank y'all so much.